Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How might a Cascade Mountain eruption be different from Hawaii's home-destroying lava spurts that we're seeing right now? That's coming up. But first, the Seattle City Council got an earful from the public this morning on its proposed employee so-called head tax. KUOW's Amy Radel is at City Hall. Hi, Amy.
Hi there.
What happened at City Hall this morning?
Well, I would say members of the carpenters and the ironworkers unions got here the earliest. They packed the hall, and then there were also, of course, people who support this tax on the other side, advocates for the homeless and homeless services. And so we were all kind of wondering if there was going to be a lot of friction between all these, you know, opposing groups. And Chris McLean with the Ironworkers 86 just kind of raised the temperature right off the bat.
I'm going to say I always thought that union negotiations had a bad name. But frankly, then we watched a city seemingly let a communist become their largest spokesperson. She seems to be getting paid by the residents of Seattle to throw temper tantrums, and we hope we know you guys know what you're doing.
Yeah, and so then Council Member Rob Johnson said, you know, let's stop with personal attacks on individual council members. Let's keep the discussion on the policy. Should the city enact this employee hours tax to raise money for homeless services? And actually, the temperature kind of calmed down at that point. And his comments highlighted the fact that labor is very divided over this. You know, these construction workers don't want the pause on construction that Amazon has threatened if the city enacts the tax. And then SEIU, Teamsters, community college staff, they put out a letter today saying they support the tax. They want the additional funding for homeless services. And Councilmember Sawant, the target of his ire, asked to respond to his comments as well.
I just wanted to reiterate that my brothers and sisters who do not support the tax, we stand with you in fighting for jobs and affordable housing. Let's not accept the false dichotomy, and let's put the blame on Amazon, who can easily afford to continue the construction, not hold the jobs hostage, and pay this pocket change tax. Let's make sure we remember an injury to one is an injury to all.
Amy, after last week's city council hearing in Ballard, we ran a story with the headline, "The Day Seattle Nice Died." So let's check the vital signs. How's Seattle Nice doing anymore, Amy?
Yeah, I think people who treasure Seattle Nice can feel a little better about today's event. You know, it actually was a pretty thoughtful discussion with a lot of opposing but well-thought-out positions. And Sarah Mae Brereton was a small business owner who spoke, and she said, please don't vilify business owners. And she said that she has been homeless and, in fact, voted for Kashama Sawant. She has a business, a cheese-making business, but she does oppose this tax.
To the rest of the council, our businesses are not your enemy. Council Member O'Brien, you're not mentally ill or sick. You're a good man.
Thank you.
I simply disagree with your support of a bankrupt housing policy. I come in peace, but demand effective, accountable, humane policy. Vote no on this regressive legislation.
Vote no, says that council hearing attendee. Amy Radel, let's talk about the votes. At last count, the head tax has 5 yes votes on a 9-person council. 6 yes votes would mean the mayor can't veto it. So did the city council signal any change in their level of support today?
No, the council members that I have gotten to today are still undecided. Council Member Deborah Juarez said she still has a lot of questions and concerns about it. And then Council Member Bruce Harrell spoke, but he even termed his answer a politician's answer and said that he is also kind of up in the air and there's a lot of negotiation still to happen.
I also don't think we've convinced the public that we are spending our money wisely in terms of solving the problem of homelessness. I also think the issue of housing affordability is a very complex issue that many major cities are struggling with. And so I want to make sure that all of that is considered during this head tax discussion. And quite candidly, I don't think it has been properly considered. So that's my goal here in the next couple of days.
Okay, so we want to know what happens next with this debate, Amy.
So we are looking at possibly a committee vote this Friday if some of these questions do get answered, and then a full council vote has been set for Monday.
Okay, you've just heard from Councilmember Bruce Harrell and other attendees at this city council hearing this morning, a public hearing on Seattle's proposed employee head tax. That's KUOW's Amy Radel live at Seattle City Hall. Amy, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The Record. It continues. Volcano time in a moment. We'll talk about scent-free workplaces and more. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Have you been watching videos from Hawaii? Molten lava eating up telephone poles and cars, destroying dozens of homes. And after you watch that, do you turn eastward toward Mount Rainier and Mount Baker and Mount St. Helens and wonder, could that happen here? Well, here to ease your fears or stoke them, we'll see, is Seth Moran. He is the scientist in charge, that's an official title, scientist in charge at the USGS Cascades Volcano Observatory. Welcome, Seth.
Good morning.
How worried should we be about a cascade eruption?
Well, I think we should all go about our days realizing that it can happen. And we know that from Mount St. Helens 1980 and Mount St. Helens 2004. And that those eruptions kind of came out of nowhere, where it was just kind of there. And then in the case of 1980, on March 20th, there was a magnitude 4. And then 7 days later, there was an explosion.
Was it literally, when you say out of nowhere, I mean, there had been rumblings and steam and stuff, right?
That was, it all started March 20th was the first earthquake. That was the first real sign that it was getting ready to go. And then 7 days later, that was the first explosion. And then from there, there were plenty of rumblings and explosions. But going from, you know, nothing happening to all of a sudden explosion, that was 7 days.
7 days. What kind of warning systems are in place today?
So for most of the volcanoes, we've got sort of adequate networks. Mount St. Helens has a great network. Mount Rainier has a good one.
What's a good network?
A good network. So Mount St. Helens has about 20 seismic stations, 20 GPS stations. That's one of the best networks in the world. Mount Rainier's got about half that, nine seismic, and that's not quite where we'd like it to be, but it's good for sort of basic monitoring. There's other volcanoes that are less good shape. Glacier Peak only has one seismic station, and we're working on plans and as resources become available, plans for improving that situation.
And the other two would be Baker and Adams. Those would be the five Cascade peaks that are active
in Washington.
In Washington State,
yes.
Right? And so, what would an eruption likely look like compared to what we're seeing with Mount Kilauea in Hawaii?
Yeah. So in the Washington Cascades, the eruption would be almost for sure very different. It would be like what we saw at Mount St. Helens. The lava that comes out of the ground is a lot stickier. And so it doesn't, flow quite as easily for one thing, and you don't get these beautiful fire fountains.
Fire fountains.
Yeah,
that's it.
Also that because it's sticky, it holds the gas in better, and so you can get a lot more buildup of pressure, and that can lead to more explosive type behavior. And so you could get ash clouds, and ash would go downwind, which is mostly towards the east, but on occasion, like we know from last summer when we had the fires coming in and got ash in the Puget Sound area, there are days when the winds can blow to the west. So that's one thing. Another thing that's actually quite different from Hawaii is that we can get volcanic mud flows, and that comes about with getting hot rock on top of snow and ice. And one of the things that makes the Cascade volcanoes so spectacular is that they've all got snow and ice on them, and Mount Rainier in particular. There have been a number of these large mud flows that, in volcano speak, we call them lahars, which is an Indonesian term, and there have been 8 or 9 of those in the last 6,000 years that have been produced mostly in association with eruptions that have reached into places where people are now living. And so that's very different from what the kinds of hazards that happen in Hawaii.
Yes. How much lahar warning would there be for people living near these Cascade volcanoes?
Right. So the most likely scenario is that a lahar would happen only when the volcano is restless or erupting. And so in that sense, there would be warning that volcano's waking up, and then you would really start taking this lahar thing seriously. The last time, however, that Mount Rainier produced a large lahar 500-plus years ago, that was something called the electron mud flow that came off of the west side, Sunset Amphitheater area, and there is no geologic record of an eruption happening at that time. So that has sort of that scenario is that potentially that happened without any kind of eruptive warning, and potentially could have happened with no warning. It just could have been a landslide that happened. And there have been landslides like that elsewhere. Mount Meager up in Canada had a fairly decent landslide about, you know, 6-7 years ago. That just kind of happened. And so there is that potential, and we take that potential very seriously. We've been working with Pierce County the last number of years to put in a system there that's on the Puyallup River and the Carbon River in particular, but expanding it to other parts of Mount Rainier that is really geared towards the Lahar detection scenario.
So I realize this, I assume this is very unlikely, but are you saying that theoretically the people in Enumclaw, Ording, you know, I don't know, Puyallup, big places near Rainier, theoretically there could be a Lahar or a massive mud flow with no mountain waking up, no eruption warning, no warning at all?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that that's a possibility, given this geologic record that there's been one without any geologic evidence of an eruption. And sort of, you know, it's I guess, you know, you don't want to get overly hyped on the worst case scenario, but it's important to take it into consideration, especially one that happened, you know, as relatively recently as 500 years ago. And so, you know, it's something that Pierce County has expressed interest in, and we're working towards that goal of being able to provide, you know, as much warning as possible of the event and of what's happening downstream.
In Hawaii, people were living in neighborhoods where lava suddenly erupted and destroyed homes. Is anyone living in a place where they could be hurt by sudden cascade lava?
Well, so again, you know, with this Lahar scenario, it would not take that long for the Lahar to reach into a large Lahar, for people to reach into populated areas. It would take something on the order of 40, 50, 60 minutes for it to reach into Ording, that much less time for communities that are closer, like Ashford, where potentially it could get there as little as 20 minutes. So that's sort of one end of the spectrum. In terms of lava, like what we're seeing in Hawaii with, you know, fissures opening up under subdivisions, that particular kind of eruption is not what we typically see in the Cascades, because the lava that we get here is a lot stickier and doesn't sort of flow out like that. And we also don't have
no
people,
fire fountains. As
yeah,
you said.
No, not well. There are places, but not in Washington's a lot less likely. But mm-hmm. In Oregon, there's been a lot more magmas come out of the ground, or you know, over the last 100,000 years than in Washington. And if you go down into central Oregon and you look around the landscape, there's all these little lumps, and those are all cinder cones. All these little mountains, little lump-like mountains,
mm-hmm.
and those are all cinder cones that have erupted, like what is happening in Hawaii. And there's kind of a broad area where magma could come out of the ground again, and that area does include communities. And so there is the potential that that kind of thing could play out down there. It's not nearly as likely as it is in Hawaii, in the sense that eruptions in the Cascades aren't nearly as frequent as they are in Hawaii, but it's a place where it could happen.
And just to have a big city bias for a moment, Seattle, Tacoma, are they at risk from a Lahar?
So the Lahar, you know, in terms of the Lahar itself reaching into downtown Seattle, that's not a very likely scenario were it to happen. But the impact of a Lahar would be for sure felt up and down the Puget Sound for a long time. Even if the Lahar itself kind of stopped at, like, say, Sumner, there'd be lots of flooding issues in the years to decades down the road, because there'd be a lot of sediment all of a sudden in this river valley, and that sediment has to move. And so it would be moving and making things pretty difficult for communities living downstream in terms of flooding, and that would last for a long time.
I saw that the unofficial Mount Rainier Twitter account tweeted, "Everyone go out and buy a gallon of water, a wind-up radio, all of the lava-resistant clothes you can find."
Mm-hmm.
What precautions can people actually, and like, we can prepare for earthquakes by stabilizing our buildings, but mm-hmm. there's no way to prepare for a Lahar except to not live in Enumclaw, is there?
Well, it's, you know, I think with a lot of, you know, we who have chosen to live in this beautiful place, the Pacific Northwest, it's beautiful in part because it's an active landscape, and part of the shaping of the landscape are earthquakes, and part of it is volcanoes, and there's also floods and things like that. So I think it's important for people to be aware of the kinds of things that can happen where they're living and what is the relative likelihood of those things, and you know, make sure that you're really making an informed decision about where you choose to live. And you know, people can accept risks at have different ideas of what acceptable risk is. But it's really important to be informed. And the hard thing for me to hear about is people who are living in a certain hazard zone and they weren't aware of it. That's the real tragedy. And that's where our role really comes in, is to make sure people are aware of what could happen and also the relative likelihood.
What is the threat level for Mount St. Helens, which has been active in very recent years?
Yeah, so in terms of alert levels, all of the Cascade volcanoes are at normal green right now, and there's no sign that any one of them is really moving in any direction. Mount St. Helens is the most seismically active volcano that we have, and we see a couple earthquakes a day. Sometimes that goes up to tens, maybe hundreds a day, but we've kind of come to know that that's normal. In terms of sort of the threat side of things, threat or risk is sort of the same word, I guess. There's two parts to it. One is the hazard, which is what can happen, what does the volcano do, how frequently does it do it, and the other is the exposure of people to those products from the volcano. And so Mount St. Helens, most frequently active, it certainly scores high on that. But in terms of having people nearby, it doesn't have that nearly as much as, say, Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier's got a lot more people that are exposed should it erupt, although it's not as likely to erupt as Mount St. Helens.
Okay, so there's a bit of good news. Code green. No, we're at threat level green so far for all our Cascade active volcanoes, the big five.
Yeah.
Seth Moran is scientist in charge at the USGS Geological Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory. Seth, thanks a lot for all the information.
You're welcome.
We are, as Seth just told you, in an active landscape. Not so many fire fountains, though, as Hawaii. That's good to know. Thanks for tuning into The Record. We're going to be right back. Stay tuned. Okay, KUOW's The Record continues, and our next segment began with an all-staff email. It was about an anonymous note that a KUOW employee had written asking for a scent-free workplace policy. And that sparked some lively debate on the Record team and got us wondering about fragrance in the workplace. Is your workplace smell an innocent self-expression, or is it an imposition on your helpless colleagues? If you have experience with a fragrance-free office, we'd like to hear your story. So please give us a call right now. We might put you on the air, 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. My guests are Ellen Covey, perfumer and professor of psychology. What a great combination, at the University of Washington. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And Jesse Hardy, fragrance specialist at Nordstrom. Welcome.
Thank you for having me also.
Jesse, do you know of non-medical offices that have scent-free policies?
Yes.
This is a thing.
It is a very common thing.
What would be a typical scent-free policy? No what?
Usually they're several pages long.
Oh.
And you can't wear, in these scent-free environments, scented shampoos, conditioners, lotions, sometimes makeup that is scented.
Mm-hmm.
You can't use scented soaps. Mm-hmm. You can't use fragrance, obviously.
Okay. And this is a growing trend, you say?
Definitely.
Okay. Ellen, I would think at some point, no soap at all would add to the body odor of a workplace. So there's some fine line here, right?
Well, it could, but not necessarily.
Oh?
People can certainly keep themselves clean without scented soap. They don't need to have scent. Scent,
yeah, scented
probably
soap
evolved as a cover for other smells. So perfumers, like dogs that roll in stuff, want to mask their own odor. So this was one of the original uses for perfume. Back in Shakespeare's time, people dumped civet on themselves.
Civet? What's civet?
Civet is...
I'm curious, because you're looking around like, can I say what civet is on public radio?
Well, civet is basically a secretion from a cat. civet cat.
Civet?
Yes, so it's an animal product. So it's one animal putting another animal's product on itself to smell different from their normal smell.
Okay, first of all, is there such thing as a scent-free soap? I mean, there's mild scents, but soap smells like something.
Not really.
No?
No, soap smells like soap.
Okay, there is scent-free soap.
It's got its own smell, but if you were to clean yourself with non-scented soap, that would basically evaporate away before you had to deal with people.
Okay, now, I should say there are legitimate reasons, aren't there, why someone wouldn't want to smell other people's smells. There could be medical sensitivities, right? Someone could be very sensitive because they're pregnant, but they don't want everybody to know that. Or right? What's the case for a scent-free workplace?
Basically, being able to do your work without distractions and not offending the people that come to that workplace. So not offending your clients in some way or bothering them. And that's a whole different issue from chemical sensitivities, which would be actually, if they're a real thing, something that people would want to avoid.
But Jesse, you think this is oversensitivity and you blame the hippies. True?
No, the hippies are full of patchouli.
Modern, I feel like there's a lot of there's a lot of misunderstanding around scent and sensitivities. Ellen was saying if they are real, multiple chemical sensitivity is the name for the condition, and it hasn't been definitively proven to be a real physiological response.
Are people truly allergic to scent?
You can be. You can have an allergy to a certain molecule, a specific element, but to be allergic to all scents is not really a thing.
That's not a thing.
No, that is not a thing.
Well, of course, how could you be allergic to all?
And what
no
people
one's claiming
call,
that, are they?
And what people call allergies often are just irritations. So I find a lot of cheap perfumes irritating. I don't like to be around people who are wearing too much bad perfume.
Bad perfume.
Bad perfume.
So then isn't that an elegant solution to just say no perfume in the workplace?
No, I don't think so. Because people often find perfume relaxing. They find it to make them more empathetic with people because they're feeling good.
But
they're
not so empathetic that they're willing to leave their perfume at home.
No. You don't get me wrong. The problem is a lot of people over-apply perfume, and this is what leads to one of the whole workplace issues, is people who put on 6 sprays of a very strong perfume, and they've adapted to it themselves, so they can't really smell it. Just like people don't smell their own body odor, really, other people can smell it. Or you don't smell your house when you live in it, but if you come back after 2 months, you can smell it. So this is adaptation. So people should not keep using the same perfume because they will get used to it. And people who get as they get older sometimes lose their sense of smell and keep putting on more and more and more perfume in order to be able to smell it themselves.
Okay, then let's talk about some solutions. We're talking about fragrance-free offices, workplaces. We'd like to hear your story. Our phone number is 206-543-5869, 543-5869. Ellen Covey is a perfumer and psychology professor at University of Washington. Jesse Hardy, you're a fragrance specialist at Nordstrom. Do you help people with this sensitivity problem? Like you'll tell them you want one pump of this. Versus, you know, and here's a perfume that goes this far, and here's one that stays close to you. Can you help people?
Definitely. I mean, different perfumes have different performance as far as projection or longevity. And application is usually the thing that is the big ticket to how offensive or loud a scent is.
You know, like how big a pump, how many pumps?
Precisely.
Or you put it on your, spread it on you or whatever?
Correct.
I'm not a perfume guy.
Yeah, if you want to be subtle about it, the best way to do it is simply to put a tiny dab on a place where your clothes cover it, and then you can enjoy it yourself, but not subject everyone else to it.
Do you have, at Nordstrom, Jesse, do you have certain types of perfume that you know are better for a workplace or better for going out or being at home or being outside?
Well, definitely, because the concentration varies dramatically and the technical performance of a fragrance is largely dependent on the ingredients. But again, really, application is key to reducing the footprint of your scent.
And the nature of the perfume. You don't want to go into a workplace with something that's reeking of musk, for example, because a lot of people might find that offensive.
I did wear musk as a teenager.
Yeah.
I had my little fling with, was it Jovan or
Jovan
something
musk.
Like that?
Yeah. Huh? Odie Wild musk.
That was
There's
me.
A yeah. lot of musks.
In the 1980s.
But I think something a lot of people lose sight of is that it's not just perfume in the workplace or fragrance, functional fragrances and products. It's also the things that are in the workplace. So if people are eating, drinking in the workplace, that's all going to have an odor.
Sure.
And the components that make up that workplace have an odor. So there can be off-gassing from carpets mm-hmm. or construction panels or any number of things. If an exterminator comes in and sprays. So fragrance-free environments would have to take all that into account. Because perfume is only a small component of it.
Yes, I would think the carpets and the physical building is probably the dominant smell in most workplaces.
Yes.
Definitely.
However, when it comes to pro-con, you know, if this is a workplace argument people are having, if someone might not like my scent, why would I wear it? I mean, for example, I will put, I don't mind the smell of fish in the microwave. When I do that, I'll come into my little work sort of pod and I'll ask, is this bothering? Is this okay? Is this, but if there were a vote in our workplace that said no fish in the microwave, I would stop. And if there were a vote that said no scented deodorant or whatever, I would go find a scent-free deodorant. Isn't that just the considerate thing to do?
Yeah, it all comes down to common sense. But on the other hand, you don't want to micromanage people. I am not a big fan of micromanagement. I think people need to work this out, not necessarily as a policy, but on an individual basis. If there's a person who is sensitive to perfume, or if there's a person who doesn't like someone else's perfume, they could talk to that person individually rather than trying to institute a blanket policy, a law for everybody.
Oh, my gosh. That seems way harder, actually, having to talk to someone about their personal scent.
Oh,
maybe, Jesse, maybe it's easy for you because you're an expert at Nordstrom.
It just seems like it would be a normal thing that human resources would have to deal with on a daily basis.
Why not make it an HR thing? Why would I have to come to someone personally and say, I am feel offended by the way you smell?
Okay, let me give you an analogy. If your neighbor's dog were coming and digging holes in your yard, would you call animal control first or would you talk to your neighbor?
Okay, I suppose I would talk to my neighbor about that.
But
the dog is on... I think we would both agree, the neighbor would, I assume, would say, oh, your dog tore up your lawn, that's my bad. But whereas I think if I would say, I don't like your smell, they would say, I don't like the fact that you're telling me you don't like my smell.
Well, you can actually be diplomatic about it.
Yeah,
and
true.
And say that, you know, I am sensitive to perfume. I have noticed that you are wearing a very strong perfume, and maybe you can't smell it for yourself because you're adapted to it. I would appreciate it if you would... back off on it.
I mean, I feel like you should have some kind of relationship with the people you work with.
Yes.
And be able to communicate. I think it makes a lot more sense. I agree with Ellen to have a case by case basis. Like you said, you go around and ask people, like, do you mind the smell of fish in the microwave? That's really courteous.
But I'm the offender. I don't mind asking. I didn't mind at all that this person wrote an anonymous note and said, hey, scent-free workplace. It seems like, yeah, that should be anonymous, not a confrontation or a gentle reminder. But I want to take a call. This is someone who's living this, Melissa in Bellevue. Melissa, what is your fragrance or fragrance-free experience?
Hi. I work in the nonprofit sector, and I worked in both buildings that had scent-free workplaces and then not. And I I haven't seen the multi-page policies that your contributor mentioned before, but when it's just understood that part of being a professional in the modern era is that you're courteous to whoever might be next to you who might be suffering from asthma and allergies like myself. And so wearing perfume in the workplace is just no longer considered professional. And you just never know who around you is going to be suffering. So if you get called into a meeting room, for instance, and you're having a conversation and someone is wearing really strong perfume, you're affecting that person's ability to not only breathe, but perform well in that meeting.
Yeah, so yeah, that's my question. Thank you, Melissa. So you could be offending someone. You could be, someone might have asthma or allergies. Why do it? What's so important about your even putting on a scent in the workplace?
Well, I don't know that it is. I mean, I personally don't wear perfume very much because I work with it, so I can't. But
That smell would ruin
interfere with what I'm doing.
Okay.
And I have never really worn perfume that much. I like to smell things because it's a pleasant experience. And I do it for the experience, not as part of my getting dressed routine, which is what has been sold to people in this culture. So part of the idea is selling, and I think a lot of the problem with perfume comes from the commercial aspects of it, where people are told that in order to be acceptable in society, they have to smell a certain way. And that perfume can be a sexual attractant, or it can make you be more glamorous, or it can make you more successful professionally. So there are all different kinds of ways of selling perfume.
Jesse, so we have one more minute for Jesse to any last thoughts on fragrance in the workplace. Jesse, the Nordstrom fragrance special.
Just always be courteous to your coworkers and have an open communication between coworkers. There are lots of things you can't control in an environment, and to implement a blanket policy is beyond a reasonable accommodation.
Jesse Hardy, fragrance specialist at Nordstrom. Ellen Covey, perfumer and professor of psychology at University of Washington. Thank you for this.
Thank you for having us on the show.
By the way, you know who was scent-free last night? The Seattle Mariners did not stink. Especially non-smelly was the Mariners' Canadian-born pitcher, James Paxton.
The left-hander from Ladish, British Columbia, has just no-hit the Blue Jays on his native soil.
Yeah, Paxton threw a no-hitter last night, only the sixth in the team's history. Felix Hernandez seems improved over last year, and the Mariners are just a game out of first place, which smells even sweeter. We're going to be right back with more of The Record. We've heard the jokes on late night about Donald Trump and his dictatorship tendencies.
Trump told the Pentagon to plan a military parade. All right, check your cards. Who has dictator bingo? Yeah. There you go. I got close. I was close. I had rallies and attacked the free press. I didn't have military parade.
But if we were really playing dictator bingo with Donald Trump, there would probably be a Stephen Colbert goes to prison square. What is comedy like under an actual authoritarian regime? We have two writers who know, satirist Gary Steingart and University of Washington professor Sasha Sendrovich. Both came to America from Soviet Russia as kids. Sasha explains why even today Putin isn't really mocked on the big network TV stations in Russia.
One of the first things that happened as Putin was solidifying control in the early 2000s was the closure of the satirical TV show called Dolls or Kukli. Puppets, Kukli, which was written by Viktor Shenderovich, who almost sounds like me, but not me, which had existed all through the Yeltsin years in the 90s. And the Putin puppet was so offensive that first they banned the Putin puppet. Mm-hmm. And then the next episode that they did was had, you know, Burning Bush talking instead of Putin. So then they, you know, banned the show. So that was the first crackdown on satire.
I remember those puppets from years ago. Yeah. What was the Putin puppet? What was basically the gag?
I don't remember. It was so long ago. Yeah. 2002 is when
I was young and full of hope.
Yes. Well, how do you compare American comedy to Russian comedy?
Well, I mean, you know, coming from the Soviet Jewry, there's a lot of similarity, this kind of absurdist Jewish humor, the sort of humor from the edge of the grave. But the first thing I remember as a child was my parents would tell political jokes very quietly, you know. But the idea was always that outside you had to be a certain way, but inside you could actually say whatever you wanted because you implicitly trusted your family, the family unit. And I think today there's something very similar. You know, everything is about the family unit, but there's no real societal unit. Nobody thinks of anything beyond their kitchen table.
In Russia.
In Russia.
Yeah.
We may get there soon, too.
Right. There's this mythology of the kitchen, of the Soviet kitchen, as the place where it was possible to have these intimate conversations, including to tell jokes, though you did that very carefully at different points in Soviet history because you never know who your guests were.
Or which appliances were listening. Yeah.
Or which appliances were listening.
Was that a literal truth that you would think about being spied on, the average person?
Not the average
person. Okay, not the average person. Okay. But it has come back, the sort of the myth of the kitchen has returned, mm-hmm. and people are again sort of feeling, some of them anyway, cast out back into that very private, intimate sphere.
Back into the kitchen.
Back into the kitchen.
And the kitchen, by the way, is covered in vodka bottles. So,
okay.
Which facilitates the truth-telling.
Indeed.
Late into the night.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a memory of the humor around the table with your parents?
I do.
No, what do you remember?
I remember... This joke is hard to tell over the radio. You need to be, it's a very visual joke, but it's a joke about Brezhnev, who was completely senile, attending the 1980s Moscow Olympics and getting everything wrong because he could barely talk.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's a great joke.
But they would do their Brezhnev impressions.
Yes. He comes up, right, and somebody gives him a speech to read, right, and he's completely senile, and he starts reading the speech, and he makes these circular motions with his finger, and he goes, "Oh! Mm. Oh! Mm. Oh! Mm." And somebody runs up, his assistant, and says, "Comrade General Secretary, those are just the Olympic rings."
That he's tracing and reading.
Tracing and reading the rings. So anyway, I mean, from that joke to Trump is just a hop and a skip, you know. Incompetence, senility, etc.
What do you think when you hear Trump called authoritarian?
Are we there yet? I mean, it's hard to say. So far, he's buffoonish in a way that, you know, a good, true authoritarian is more controlled, I suppose. And so would be the access to humor and satire. So Trump is laughable. And while we laugh at Trump, Scott Pruitt is destroying the environment and Betsy DeVos is destroying education and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not yet, I think, quite at the point where we can't make fun of him. Maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, I think he has authoritarian instincts. I think they haven't been fully carried out because we still have some democratic institutions left, right?
Right.
So I don't think that we're there yet. But I think, as with all good authoritarians, humor hurts him quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think SNL is probably the worst part of his day is, mm-hmm. you know, waking up on Sunday and having to deal with Saturday Night Live.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, if he could close it down, of course he would. And I think he cares more about what happens on SNL than the particulars of what Scott Pruitt is doing because he can't understand them, you know.
Right.
So the only thing he can understand is how he's perceived by the people. And, you know, one thing I really do share with Trump, shockingly.
Do tell, right?
I grew up in Queens almost entirely.
Oh.
He was born in Queens. I spent from age 7 to age 18 in Queens. And all you want to do when you're in Queens is go to Manhattan and prove yourself in Manhattan. And I think the fact that, you know, that he came, he saw it, but he didn't quite conquer because he was a terrible businessman. For my upcoming novel, which has to do a lot with the finance industry, I talked to a lot of people who knew him and had business dealings with him, and everybody said, you know, he's the worst at what he does. So he couldn't quite succeed, and he was considered a buffoonish and outer borough and et cetera in Manhattan. And I think in some ways this presidential bid was an attempt to sort of leapfrog over that. But the funny thing is he's still hated in Manhattan and still considered incompetent. Right. So that dream will never come true.
Well, he certainly has tweeted at Alec Baldwin and put him down for the impersonation. The comedian Michelle Wolf caught a lot of flack for being pointed toward his administration, but I don't think anyone imagines the most powerful man in the world actually conspiring against these comedians.
But there's something different. Michelle Wolf was very different, I think, from Alec Baldwin, in not so much in as far as how Trump reacted, but how we reacted. Mm. And how many people who I consider to be very reasonable people reacted to Michelle Wolf as somehow offensive. And that was so interesting because she was not really even joking.
No.
She was basically saying things that were true in a on a stage where she was supposed to be a satirist. And satirists are not necessarily funny, mm-hmm. right? The role of satirist...
No, I'm not.
But the role of satirist to poke through some sort of veneer of... You know, what seems to be acceptable, which is what she did. And people really reacted to that because she destroyed this myth that we have this notion of civility at a time when Trump was president and that there could be a press corps that's, you know, does what it can to preserve its access to the president so they play nice. And therefore, that was somehow offensive. That's quite different from Alec Baldwin's routine, I think. That she was somehow, I think in Michelle Wolf's case, we came quite close to what it might look like to actually flip out at satirical, at satire specifically, and how that'll happen with the consent of those who see themselves as being the guardians of the free press.
Because the White House Correspondents Association apologized.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I mean, the big takeaway there was the way that the press corps reacted, or parts of it, not all of them, of course, but we all know that Sarah Huckabee Sanders tells lies, that the whole press conference from the beginning to the end is non-factual. To say that out loud while she's sitting there, oh, whatever. But it's the fact that, you know, that she basically said it to the press, hey, you've been feasting, you created this monster, right. You've been feasting off this for the last how many years. Maybe that's what pissed them off so much, because all of a sudden, people that you read and who are trying to be unbiased, like Maggie Halberman, for example, you know, the way she reacted.
From the New York Times.
From the New York Times, yes, the way she reacted to that. That it was about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' personal appearance, which, you know, all of us spent so much time trying to Google, what is it, smoky eye?
Yeah,
I Googled the hell out of smoky eye.
I learned a lot about cosmetics.
Yes, it's all, I mean, you know, I would like to have a good smoky eye. I applaud Sarah Huckabee Sanders for having good cosmetic skill. So that was unbelievable to me, the capitulation to these people whose entire careers consist now of simply lying 24/7.
And that, in the sense, is the bigger danger. It's not, some of your question is, you know, there's this premise that there'll be somebody who will clamp down and close things down. I think a lot of this kind of this give and take, you know, we're willingly conceding ground on a lot of things in the past we have in the past couple of years about what is acceptable and what isn't. That one day something might not seem unimaginable that did 2 years ago.
Yeah, you know, so for example, in Russia, there's some freedom of speech. There is some. So Putin, for example, you can write in a novel, you can write whatever you want because it's not considered important enough. The news and television networks is something that Putin controls, but you can write an anti-Putin novel. That would be okay. There's a few newspapers, although their journalists often get murdered.
Novels were cherished in Russia.
Not really. Huh. Not, I mean, yes, but I think like everywhere else, they're becoming...
They're starting to put theater directors in jail.
Maybe it will. I mean, when writers get arrested again, that will be an exciting time. But there's no danger of that here. Trump has never read a novel in his life.
Gary, you've written that your parents and grandparents never fully recovered from the strains of having lived in an authoritarian society, even after moving to the United States?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, and it's interesting because many, many Soviet Jews of that generation are quite Republican and support Trump, quite a few. So I think...
What's the connection between Soviet Jews and Trump?
Well, Soviet Jews were always fairly Republican, that generation. I grew up fairly Republican, too. It wasn't until Oberlin College that I was set straight. So, you know, I think a lot of it came from the same way, you know, that many Cuban Americans or that generation was also very Republican because you simply wanted to be against the party that you perceived to be as left as possible. And that was the Democratic Party, which, of course, had nothing in common with socialist parties in Cuba and the Soviet Union. But anyway.
And they appreciated the country that they had come to.
Yes, exactly. And they thought that the Republicans could prosecute the Cold War better than Democrats. But, you know, I think that the degradation of social life is such in an authoritarian regime that even if there is a kitchen table and that's where you know, come together and you take care of each other as a family arrayed against a very inhospitable world, that's still some of the effects of living in a totalitarian system trickle down. you can't just live listening to lies all day long. You can't have, you know, Huckabee Sanders on stereo for 24 hours a day and somehow emerge, you know, fully intact. And I know that many psychiatrists are talking about the fraying of so many of their patients and family units, et cetera. I mean, this is only year one, but I think, and this is not a full authoritarian regime, but it certainly commands the same attention as an authoritarian regime. Remember, you know, in the Soviet Union, you'd wake up in the morning, right? You'd go outside, there'd be a giant plaque that would say, you know, glory to blah, 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 the American capitalist pigs, et cetera, et cetera. But we go on social media, we go on wherever, and Trump is there. You know, even if he's being attacked and hated, he's still there. There's a kind of omnipotence to him these days, which really reminds me of what an authoritarian system would look like.
The Cold War supposedly ended decades ago. How do the two of you view the U.S.-Russia relationship?
You know, I just thought when the Cold War ended, I thought that, you know, Russia would become more and more like America, the markets, the democratic institutions. But America's become more and more like Russia. We are we are the understudies for an oligarchy at this point.
Understudies.
That's what we're trying to do. This is the direction. This is what Trump believes in. I mean, I'm sure we'll discover many wonderful relationships that he's had with Russians and his, you know, all the people that have worked for him. But the mentality of Trump is oligarchical at this point, and Russia is the home of the oligarchs, you know.
But the important caveat that, you know, we in America were en route to oligarchy before Trump as well, right? Whatever that Princeton study was from a few years ago that looked at various American economic data points and sort of basically as we are already in oligarchy.
That's
before
true.
Trump.
Because of the concentration of wealth?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. So in the way that our political system is set up to be able to influence political decisions with the influence.
Money
cash.
And politics, safe members of Congress.
Yeah. Right. So look, so Russia has oil and natural gas, and we have tech and finance. And granted, tech is a lot, you know, there's a lot more hope for what tech can do, whereas natural gas or oil is just a static resource. But still, you know, everything's concentrated in just a few pockets in this country. We're in one of them, I think, now. I just passed by a caviar store. I was walking through the lake.
East Lake.
Could be East Lake.
I think it was East Lake.
Most likely.
Yeah. I was going from the University District by foot. I like walking. So I walked for an hour and a half from University District to Belltown.
Yep.
And I saw this caviar store that I think was the biggest caviar store I've ever seen. It was gigantic. It was all beluga, too, you know, which is the best. I was like, wow, Seattle is, you know, Putin would feel welcome here.
Did you buy any caviar?
I didn't. No, I'm you know, just a poor writer.
Uh-huh. And the sort of the other side to this is that your question was about the Cold War. I think there was a sort of American mentality in the late 80s, early 90s that, you know, we were winning and then won the Cold War and that the Soviet Union lost. There was this kind of triumphalist, you know, joyful, we sort of showed them, you know, who really is better. And I think that sort of failed to appreciate the fact what that meant for people in the former Soviet Union, you know, what it meant in terms of the kind of psychological impression it makes when it's already a, you know, collapsed economy and, you know, there's no food on the table, but there's also this, you know, kind of triumphalism coming from abroad. And also Russia, so America really ignored the Russia story for all of the 90s. The enrollments in Russian courses dropped because Russia wasn't seen as the enemy anymore, so people weren't interested in studying Russian. So you eventually ended up with this vacuum. There are no specialists in sort of Russian affairs. And Putin really exploited that really well when he came to power, that angst and anger at the West.
There was a song, something like, Russia will get off her knees.
Exactly. But the getting from the knees was so important, much more important than actually having a diversified economy
People would choose that over economic well-being.
Right.
So it's interesting.
In a certain sense, it's not surprising at all. Where we are. Like, you could see where it was headed.
Yeah, and many Trump voters also choose this kind of dignity, perceived notions of it over material well-being.
Yes, I don't know whether President Trump has used the phrase get off our knees, but it's about the kind of thing that he has pitched.
It could be that he got it from Moscow. I'm joking, or am I? You never know.
That is writer Gary Steingart. His newest novel, Lake Success, will be published this fall. And University of Washington Assistant Professor of Slavic and Jewish Literature, Sasha Sendrovich, there. And they're going to be on stage together tonight at the University of Washington Kane Hall, 7 o'clock. Gary will read from his new book, Lake Success. Tickets are free. More information at the 2018 Strom Lecture Series website. That is The Record. Today, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Tomorrow on the show, Vishvajit Singh, a.k.a. the Sikh Captain America. He's got a new show up at the Wing Loop Museum called Wham Bam Pow, Cartoons, Turbans, and Confronting Hate. Tune in tomorrow. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.